It's the takeaway for July 23rd. Hey, Democrats, how do you feel about the party's push to the left?
I am more to the left than a center Democrat. I think the push to the left is good for the 99% in this country, but I do believe it may cost the Democratic Party the White House.
I am not really worried about the push to the left. I do believe in taking incremental steps, however.
But I think we need to move a bit more gradually.
What the split in the Democratic Party means for the 2020 election. Also on the show, ahead of Robert Mueller's testimony, we talked to two secretaries of state about his plea for people to pay attention to Russian interference in the 2016 election.
And that allegation deserves the attention of every American.
And we check in with Puerto Rican singer Ile.
For me, this is like a peaceful army that we're doing. Like, there's a lot of Puerto Ricans everywhere in the world, and we're showing the people how we protest.
Let's get to it, everybody.
The movement. And that's exactly what this is. Not a campaign or an election day, but a movement, a larger movement for social, economic, and racial justice in the United States of America.
The Democrats got an infusion of progressive politics when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, and Ilhan Omar were elected to the House in 2018. Last month, when these four freshman representatives broke with the rest of the Democrats on a vote over an early version of a bill providing emergency funding for the border, we began to see cracks in party unity. But the party's perceived ideological split goes beyond the so-called squad. It's also appearing in some of the rhetoric from the candidates running for office in 2020, some of whom have called to decriminalize border crossings, provide Medicare for all, and others who've been pushed further to the left on issues like criminal justice reform. But some Democrats and pundits fear that this shift to the left may alienate moderate Democrats and all but ensure victory for President Trump in 2020. And we're going to talk about it now as part of our coverage of strategy and rhetoric across the political spectrum in the lead up to the 2020 election. It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. I have three guests with me to talk about all this. Lene Erickson is the senior vice president at Third Way, a center-left think tank. Hi, Lene.
Hi.
Sarah Smarsh is a journalist and author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, nice of you to be with us again.
Hi, Tanzina.
And Jamel Bowie is a columnist for the New York Times, and he's with me here in studio. Jamel, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
All right, all. So lots to talk about. Let's start with you, Jamel. I want to talk about this idea that progressive politicians are alienating moderate Democrats. What do you make of that argument?
It sort of depends on what you mean by moderate Democrats. If you mean, I guess, a sizable number of Democrats who may not be for Medicare for all, but support a public option, who may not support completely decriminalizing the border, but support a path for citizenship, it's not entirely clear to me that these Democrats are alienating the segment of the party's voters. There isn't a ton of polling on the so-called squad of lawmakers, the four progressive lawmakers who've made a lot of news recently. The polling that there is suggests that not even very many Democrats nationally have even heard of them. But if you look at the presidential race, right, where we have a broad number of Democrats representing basically every single possible segment of the party, most Democratic voters like Bernie Sanders. They like Elizabeth Warren. They like Joe Biden. They like Kamala Harris, which suggests that the moderate Democrats, maybe they're not ultimately going to vote for Bernie in a primary, but they don't dislike him. They don't think he is a problem for the party. And on the other end, more progressive Democrats, they may like Joe Biden, but they may not necessarily vote for him. And so for me, I'm sort of skeptical that among the Democratic Party, at least, that there's very much kind of division about ideology, or that division is necessarily dispositive for the election.
And Lene, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this argument that the only way for Democrats to win is really to appeal to the quote-unquote political center here.
Yeah, you know, I think Jamel's right that there's more that unites Democrats than that separates them. Certainly, the biggest thing that unites us at this point is that we want to beat Donald Trump. And we're really focused on doing that because it's existential for our country at this point. But I also think, you know, there are folks outside the kind of political Twitterverse that have a really different perception of what's important than the folks who are tweeting every single day. You know, we just did a poll of Democratic primary voters, and only 1 in 10 tweet once a day. And they had a very different viewpoint on a whole lot of issues, including single payer and immigration, than the Democratic primary voters who aren't tweeting, the 9 in 10. So most of the divide, I think, is about focus. It's about what do you actually want a candidate to focus on? Do you want them to focus on a positive vision for their how they're going to help you and make your life better, make it easier for you to have an opportunity to earn a good life? Or do you want them to focus on the latest Donald Trump tweet and how horrible it is? And I think too often we, and I include myself, I'm in Washington right now, get really focused on the most terrible thing Donald Trump did that day. And people are only in passing paying attention to that. What they're really worried about is what's going to impact their own lives.
I agree. We definitely have to step outside of the Twitterverse. Sarah, I want to bring you in here because I think often when, well, not just when I think about this, when we look at the results of the 2016 election, we saw the majority of Black women voters, Black male voters, Latino men and Latino women voted for the Democratic candidate who at the time was Hillary Clinton. Yes, there are conservative Black and brown voters, but the majority of these votes went to the Democrats. So I'm wondering if we're, when we're talking about moderate Democrats, is that code for how white voters are expected to vote? And if so, do you assume that it's fair to expect that white voters will not support whoever the Democratic candidate is?
Mm. Well, that's a great point. And I think sort of the flip of what you just summarized is that white folks at all economic rungs voted for Donald Trump by a majority. And so, you know, in terms of the way that we talk about moderate liberal thought and how that does or doesn't relate to social and racial justice on top of economic justice, I find that, let's say, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's message is just as palatable in here in my home state of Kansas. It's just a matter of how you talk about it. So a place like Kansas it's got a lot of white folks, it's got a lot of conservatives, but it also has a deep history of a progressive populism that gets left out of the modern politics conversation. It also has a whole bunch of Democrats, some of whom are moderate, some of whom are increasingly progressive. Bernie Sanders and AOC came to Kansas a year ago to hold a rally for our district congressional candidate, and they were welcomed by thousands of people who were just over the moon to have a brush with these people. And so I think that something that we're kind of leaving out of the conversation is who do we make assumptions about and how does that affect party strategy? Sometimes when I find that the candidates who throw that strategy out the window and knock on every door and don't make assumptions, the reason that Trump, in part, racism was rife in that election and it will be in 2020 as well, but in part what he did was he spoke to places that felt like they weren't being talked to by Democrats. And we know that politics is emotional and not rational. To feel validated by someone just even coming to your place that's usually left out of the national conversation goes a long way.
I just want to talk about 2018 in Kansas for a minute. It's a great example. You know, in 2018, the kind of Bernie Sanders wing of the party had a chance to make their case. They had some candidates that were running explicitly on their ideas. They, in fact, endorsed a bunch of candidates, and only a third of their candidates actually won their primaries, where about 80% of the new Dems, the kind of pragmatic progressive caucus, won their primaries. And then the new Dems went on to flip 33 seats and give Nancy Pelosi the speaker's gavel, whereas the Justice Democrats and Our Revolution did not flip a single seat from red to blue. And in fact, that candidate that Bernie Sanders came to visit, she lost her race. But the person who won was Charisse Davids, who is a really moderate, thoughtful, kind of pragmatic, progressive person of color who represents her city exceptionally well and is now a really important part of the Democratic majority in the House.
So I want to bring in this idea, not just the idea, but Tom Friedman wrote a column recently, and he says, "Dear Democrats, it's not complicated. Just nominate a decent, sane person, one committed to reunifying the country and creating more good jobs, a person who can gain the support of independents, moderate Republicans, and suburban women who abandoned Donald Trump," and he goes on. My question, Jamel, is that person real, and is that a realistic expectation?
What's funny about that argument is that in some ways, Friedman is describing the 2016 Hillary Clinton campaign as sort of a campaign aimed at people, at Republican-leaning voters disaffected with Donald Trump. And that campaign obviously did not win. Now, some of that was for reasons sort of out of everyone's control, events that you couldn't predict. Some of it was because Donald Trump, I think, part of his speaking to people who felt unheard was voicing racial prejudice, was voicing racial animus that you could legitimately say there are voters for whom that was an important thing for them as voters, but no one was speaking to it. So he spoke to that and got them to the polls. But part of it, I think, was that Clinton, by attempting to mobilize and win over disaffected Republicans, ended up demobilizing Democrats, demobilizing more traditional Democratic constituencies whose votes were just as critical to winning. Much talk about Wisconsin in 2016, about how the Clinton campaign didn't spend much time there. But Wisconsin saw a significant dip in the percentage of African Americans who came out to vote relative to 2012. And had that not happened, had there been an effort to explicitly mobilize those voters, there's a good chance that Hillary Clinton would be president. And I think an important thing to think about when trying to strategize to figure out what Democrats should do is that every action does in fact have a cost. So if your strategy, as recommended by this column, is going to be to reach out to disaffected Republicans, to conservative-leaning independents who do not like Donald Trump, one consequence of that may be not doing the kind of work you need to reach out to Democratic-based voters, to groups who would vote Democratic if they could be turned out. And that can also cost you an election. And so part of my frustration with a lot of these conversations is that other part is never really considered. The fact that, yeah, there's a cost to making one strategic choice versus the other. And if you're going to say Democrats need to do X, then you should at least contend with the potential downside of that.
Sarah, I know you wanted to weigh in on Lynae's comment. We've got about a minute left in the segment.
Yeah, I think that, you know, she makes a valid point. And I would also look at our state level election. We elected a relatively centrist female Democratic governor, makes Kansas, by the way, the only state in the nation to have elected three Democratic females to the governorship. So that right there definitely is a mark in the column of the moderate voice. I think that we can have both and, though, and I don't see this as some deep fracture in the party, but rather two groups that are existing simultaneously that ultimately want largely the same thing. And I would very much caution against alienating the further left factions of the party by blowing off their social messages about social and racial justice. And, you know, rather than going after, say, like a disenchanted Republican, I'd rather see Democrats try to mobilize folks who never get to vote at all. We had very successful efforts by the Republican Party here in Kansas and across the country.
Lynae, I want to get back to you. I want to play a call that we got from one of our listeners.
Hi, this is Pat Busher from Portland, Oregon. In response to whether I think the left is going too far, I am intrigued by many of their ideas, but I think we need to move a bit more gradually.
Lynae, what's your thought on that?
You know, I think Jamel started out by talking about the healthcare debate within the 2020 Democratic primary, and I think that's a great example. You know, there are some folks who would say we need to have a single-payer system, we're going to abolish employer-provided healthcare, and we're going to start completely new. And what I've seen in the public opinion research is that most voters are where your caller is. They're saying, you know, we really need to improve our healthcare system and, in fact, drive down costs. They're most concerned about their own healthcare cost. But they don't really want a revolution in tearing down our healthcare system. They want to be able to afford the healthcare that they and their family need, and they want to not feel like there's going to be a surprise bill that all of a sudden puts them into bankruptcy. So I think you're seeing a lot of primary candidates try to straddle that line of, you know, saying universal coverage for all and Medicare for all who want it. Let's have a public option. That's something the Democrats have supported since the debates around the ACA, and something we've supported since that point. But, you know, we don't need to tear down everything we have in order to do that. And we don't need to make the perfect the enemy of the good. We don't need to wait until we can pass a single payer healthcare system to actually make progress on reducing healthcare costs in this country.
Jamel, before we started the segment, we were talking about a Twitter thread. To go back to the Twitterverse for just a brief moment, that Tim Wise wrote over the weekend. And one of the things he started out was saying, if Dems blow this election, and this is him speaking, it will not be because they were, quote, too far left on policy or because they were, quote, weren't left enough. It will have little to do with policy at all, he says. And they're making a mistake caused by traditional consultant theory that does not apply here. Jamel, your thoughts on that?
So Wise was speaking in the context of the 1992 Louisiana gubernatorial race. I think 92, 91, early 90s. And in that race, the Democrat, Edwards, notoriously corrupt, was running against David Duke, Klansman. And Duke had run the cycle earlier for the House of Representatives. He had lost, but he gained a significant percentage of the vote. I believe he lost. Gave a significant percentage of the vote and now was aiming for the governor's mansion. And Wise, who worked on the campaign against Duke, is making the point that part of what helped them beat Duke in the general election for the governorship was not treating Duke exactly like a normal candidate, not focusing so much on his economic plan, not focusing so much on sort of ordinary scandals, but really defining the election in terms of the kind of place voters wanted Louisiana to be, and recognizing that for many voters on the left and on the center, racism, sort of inclusiveness is what you could call a kitchen table issue. It is fundamental to their conception of politics. And running on that in addition to everything else, trying to turn out voters on that basis explicitly, not talking around it, but explicitly naming that as a key issue helped the Democrats beat Duke. I think that's right. I think the 2017 Virginia statewide elections had a similar dynamic where one of the Republican candidate, Ed Gillespie, adopted the kind of race-baiting campaign of Corey Stewart, who had run in the primary for the governor's race and was running on football players kneeling and on MS-13 and all of these things. And outside groups and as well as state Democrats explicitly labeled those things as against Virginia's values, explicitly said to voters that this is not just an election about tax rates. It's an election about what kind of state you want Virginia to be. And Democrats won a smashing victory in that state. And I think there's very much something to this idea that in a upcoming election where mobilizing the entire Democratic coalition is going to be extremely important, there are a large number of Democratic voters for whom standing up to racism, to affirming the country's identity as a multiracial democracy is critical. There's almost nothing else as important. And I think Democrats will be making a mistake if they decide to shy away from that argument, because Trump is going to be making that argument. This is key. Trump is going to be talking about this. And so either you let him talk about it unmolested or you respond in kind.
And to that point, I want to ask, Lene, is the fear that folks will vote for Trump if they don't agree with the Democrats or that they won't vote at all?
I think that there's a fear of both. We need to energize people and we need to persuade them. But, you know, when you look at the winning coalition in the 2018 election, the Catalyst folks that are progressive data analysts took a look at what actually delivered Nancy Pelosi the gavel. And 89% of the increase in Democratic margin in 2018 came from voters that had voted for Trump, not folks who were new voters who had come out. And I think the 2018 playbook is what we really need to focus on here. So I think you can do both. You know, I don't think anyone didn't hear Democrats call Donald Trump a racist last time around. You know, he is, and we should say that. And you know, absolutely. But there's a difference between saying that and calling it out and focusing 100% of your attention on the most horrible thing he just said.
Sarah, your response to that?
Yeah, and I would add, I agree, and on top of that would say that what matters regionally and perhaps by group is not necessarily how far left or center, but how it is said. I hear a lot of people talking about Elizabeth Warren here in Kansas and the Midwest. She's from Oklahoma. She calls out racism. She talks about policy to help Black women, but she also simultaneously focuses very specifically on an economic platform of radical change. And that's really speaking to people here.
Jamel, Lene, and Sarah, thanks to you all for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime, Tanzina. Thanks for having me on.
Jamel Bowie is a New York Times opinion writer. Lene Erickson is senior vice president at Third Way, a central-left think tank. And Sarah Smarch is a journalist and author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Tomorrow morning, former special counsel Robert Mueller is set to testify before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees about his report on Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Most of the focus is expected to be on the question of collusion between Russian actors and the Trump campaign and whether the president obstructed justice during the investigation, which means Mueller's key findings on election security may fall by the wayside. The former special counsel underscored the importance of those findings during a press conference at the end of May.
And I will close by reiterating the central allegation of our indictments that there were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American.
More than a year out from the 2020 presidential election, we wanted to find out what's being done on the state level to combat against foreign interference at the ballot box. And I'm joined now by California Secretary of State Alex Padilla and Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Steinman. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Secretary Padilla, let's start with you. How did the 2016 presidential election and the meddling by Russian state actors change your priorities as a person in charge of California's elections?
Well, it certainly was not just an eye-opener, but a game-changer. I think prior to 2016, most people would view a Secretary of State as someone who oversees elections and should be working to increase voter registration and turnout rates, but quickly became the office most people look to ensure that there is no foreign interference in our election, significantly different than what the view was prior. And I just got to say, Special Counsel Mueller got it absolutely right. You know, the documentation of the various strategies of how to undermine our democracy are laid out in his indictments, in the report, and I do think they should get more attention in tomorrow's hearing than we've heard thus far.
Secretary Simon, the last few years have really, before the Mueller investigation, we've seen issues with our election system across the United States. The Department of Homeland Security has declared them to be critical infrastructure. And yet, when you look back to the 2016 campaign, did you notice any vulnerabilities that the election may have highlighted in that infrastructure?
Yes, absolutely. And I think Alex is right. You can divide the election world into two halves, pre 2016 and post 2016. It was absolutely a watershed event. Minnesota was one of the 21 states targeted by the Russian government. That's a fact. That's not subject to debate. And now looking back, especially with the aid of hindsight, we can see the vulnerabilities that were there. Some of them are technical. Some of them are very detailed. But some of them are just about the overall communication structure with the federal government, with intelligence authorities. And I have to say, we've come a long way since then. I think things are much, much better than they were in the 2016 election.
Secretary Padilla, how closely have you been working so far with federal officials to ensure that California's state and local elections are more secure this time around?
Well, working pretty darn closely. And I must say, the relationship and quality of our collaboration has vastly improved in the last 3-4 years. Want to also distinguish, because voters deserve to know, two types of interference we're talking about. One, you know, were there votes flipped, election results changed? That's not the case. That hasn't been seen anywhere in the country. But clearly, there was a systematic disinformation campaign, not just, but especially on social media, to try to create confusion, chaos, and undermine confidence in our elections. But the voters in America deserve better.
Secretary Simon, based on what we saw in 2016, what are your biggest concerns and, I guess, priorities when it comes to possible interference in the 2020 election?
Well, a couple come to mind. One is the spread of the techniques that the Russian government used in 2016. What the intelligence authorities have told us often, unanimously, and recently, is to expect more of this and expect it from more sources, not just the one government, but perhaps other governments, and not just governments, but perhaps non-governmental actors. The second thing that I'll be looking towards in 2020 is even better communications between the states and the federal government. It's good now, as Secretary Padilla said, but I think it could be even better, particularly in cases where, for example, if there's a county in Minnesota, my state, or California, Secretary Padilla's state, or any state that is experiencing a cyber incident or an intrusion, we have to make sure that the federal government shares that information with everybody, not just the county affected, but with the actual states that oversee the system as well. So I'll be looking to that as one of the critical areas for 2020.
And Secretary Padilla, is it even possible to prepare for a possible attack? Are there stress tests, if you will, that you can run in order to make sure that the infrastructure will be properly functioning?
Absolutely. You know, there's several years ago, in the final days of the Obama administration, the Department of Homeland Security designated our elections infrastructure as what's referred to as critical infrastructure, similar to our utilities, our banking system, et cetera. And through that process, a lot of what are considered best practices, both from the public and the private sector, have been shared and applied to the elections world. So that does involve a lot of different types of technical testing, as well as establishment of protocols for how we do share information or intelligence about incidents or threats. So that's what I point to when I say the relationship between state and federal governments has vastly improved in the last few years. But I should be specific. That relationship has improved with the rank and file professionals at the various federal agencies. Unfortunately, one of the challenges that we have going into 2020 is that work is constantly undermined by Trump. Every time he undermines the findings of our intelligence agencies, or every time Senator McConnell blocks bipartisan legislation to further invest in election security, it makes our job even harder.
Well, let's talk about that, because Congress last year did set aside about $380 million for new election equipment. 60% of that was earmarked for cybersecurity. Is that enough? And I'll pose that question to each of you, Secretary Padilla and Secretary Simon.
Well, I'll go first. Was that money helpful? Yes. Was it timely? Yes. Was it enough? Not even close. And I also want to be clear on this. That was not new money. The monies that was appropriated to state last year for election security was simply the final disbursement of Help America Vote Act dollars approved in 2002. That was meant to address butterfly ballots and hanging chads. That was never designed to be Cyber Threat 2020 funding.
Secretary Simon.
Well, I think it will tide us over in Minnesota through 2020, but in the long term, we're going to have a federal partner on the money side. You know, Department of Homeland Security, as good as they've been the last couple of years, they will come into our office, for example, and other offices for weeks at a time sometimes, camp out, write reports, make recommendations, and they're good, but they all have price tags. They have big price tags. And state budgets just aren't in a position to cope with or address those price tags. So the expense alone means that we need a federal partner here. So I'm hoping that this disbursement that we got, while we're very grateful for it, is a sign of things to come in the future. It has to be a national priority, and that means dollars attached.
Are either of you concerned that the talk of election interference and the fact that this was something that Mueller made very clear in his report did happen is something that could undermine not just the cybersecurity infrastructure, the actual machines, but also just the psychology of how voters feel about their vote being cast? Are you worried that this might affect turnout?
I do, and I think we should, because anything that creates doubt in the minds of a voter, and if it's to the point where a voter will decide not to go vote because they're not sure if their ballot will count or be counted as cast, in my book, that's a form of voter suppression. Voters deserve to have confidence in the integrity of our electoral system. I know we work diligently across the country to ensure that, but the people need to know that. They need to feel that. Honestly, if 2018 is any indicator, in California, we had record registration and record turnout. So to me, that's a great sign that people are paying attention, not just to politics, but the extent to which we're working to ensure the integrity of the vote.
Secretary Simon.
Yeah, I mean, the Russian goal in 2016, apart from any preference they might have had in the outcome, was to sow confusion, to sow doubt, and to raise questions about our election system. The good news is we've rallied in the last two or three years here. And I think, speaking for Minnesota, we too had record turnout. We were number one in the country in voter turnout. And I think people are getting the message that no votes were changed. We're on it. The federal government is partnering with us. But there is always that danger that someone might conclude that their vote just won't be safe. And we want to dispel that notion. We want to let people know that we're ready. We're poised to meet the threat. We can't guarantee that there won't be any intrusion or attempted intrusion, but we can do the best that we can do, and we are, to make sure that the election system is safe.
Are either of you concerned, as we mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, that it's unlikely that the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees would touch much on election security in these hearings that we're expected to hear tomorrow with Special Counsel Robert Mueller? Are you worried that there isn't enough federal and national conversation about this? Secretary Padilla.
There's certainly attention, not just in the House, but in the Senate as well. But we don't have is leadership in the Senate that will allow for bipartisan measures to advance, bipartisan measures to not just establish higher security standards for how we conduct elections in America, but to support those standards with the funding that's necessary to tackle modern day threats against our democracy and, frankly, the age of our voting infrastructure across America.
California Secretary of State Alex Padilla and Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon were with us. Thanks to you both. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Mass demonstrations in Puerto Rico have already forced a number of top political leaders to resign, and calls for Governor Ricardo Rosselló to resign continue to grow louder, even after he announced that he would not seek re-election. And as the protests continue, one song has been deemed the anthem of this moment.
Disculpen mis expresiones, pero al igual que Ricky, estoy liberando las tensiones. Le doy fuego a la fortaleza como se supone y al otro día voy a la iglesia para que me perdonen. Mejor no quieras probar de que...
That's Afilando los Cuchillos, or Sharpening the Knives, a song released last week, and it features Puerto Rican artists Residente, Bad Bunny, and Ile.
Vamos cortante. Como los cuchillos, sacando chispa hasta llegar al filo. Hay que arrancar la maleza del plantío, pa' que ninguno se aproveche de lo mío.
And I'm joined now by one of the songwriters of Puerto Rico's revolutionary anthem, singer-songwriter Ileana Cabra, better known as Ile, is with us, and her latest album, Almadura, is out today. Ile, thanks so much for being with us again.
Thank you so much. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And you have been on the ground in Puerto Rico during the protests. Tell us what you're seeing on the streets of Puerto Rico right now.
Well, I'm seeing a huge, unexpected awakening all of a sudden. I never knew that this would happen from one day to another. But it feels great. It's shameful at the same time. But the important thing is that we have woken up in big, giant masses, and every day keeps growing and growing, and that is an amazing feeling that I've been waiting for so long to see with my own eyes, and I think my grandmother and people that are not with us anymore are feeling proud wherever they are, because we have shown our true selves finally in the streets nowadays, and we're living in a history, so it feels very good.
And the song that we just heard a clip of, and that was recorded with Residente and hip-hop star Bad Bunny, and people are calling it the anthem of this moment. Tell us more about the song, like the idea behind it, and who were the three of you singing to?
Well, it was an initiative from my brother René and Benito and Bad Bunny, and they invited me to participate in the chorus. So we were each writing our own things in different places, but since we are Puerto Ricans, we share the same anger and we are indignant as well as the rest of the country. So we're just telling the story through this song. We are just showing that anger in our own different way of expression. So my brother René is muy directly and toward the governor of Puerto Rico and Benito as well, but he also includes other people of the party and of the government, and my chorus is just the part about the people of gathering everyone together in big masses and react and protect what is ours. So it's just our way of expressing ourselves, and it's nice to hear this song on the streets every day that I've been protesting in Puerto Rico, and I know it gives like a necessary boost that we need, and a support and a solidarity that is very important to keep it up at this time, and we're not stopping.
There's a line in the song that you guys mention, and it says, "Tú no eres hijo del cañaveral Escoria, tú eres hijo del más corrupto de la historia." And that roughly translates to, "You're not the son of the sugarcane fields. You are the son of one of the most corrupt people in history." Who are you talking about there, Ile?
That was written by my brother René. He's actually referring to the governor, that he's son of a former governor from Puerto Rico. He's saying that you're son of the governor, of the most corrupt governor in history. So that's why this governor thinks he's going to get away with this, and that's why he's not respecting the people at all. He's underestimating our capabilities of reacting and doing more and doing what we can until he's out. I mean, it's shown like more than enough that we don't want him there, and he's asking for forgiveness, and people who want to forgive him can forgive him, but he has to suffer the consequences. I mean, what he did was terrible, as well as his dad, but by that time his dad didn't had all the information that we have nowadays about his son. And well, his raising, the way that he was raised, has a lot to do with his personality. And that's why he thinks he's going to get away with all this. But we're going to show him that he's not.
I mean, we're seeing images here in New York from what's happening. We have protests even here. The diaspora is protesting and being very inclusive about what they're doing. We saw hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans on the island yesterday and for weeks already. Are people optimistic that Governor Rosselló will actually step down?
It's not about optimism. It's a reality. He has to confront that reality, and we would do whatever we have to do for him to know that what he has to do. And we will not stop. I arrived Saturday from New York last Saturday. I mean, the 13th of July, and I've been protesting since, and I haven't stopped, and the people haven't stopped either. I had this trip now, and then I will go back, and I'll keep protesting. Like, now it's just our way of life. Like, this is very important, and people are risking jobs, are risking a lot of things, just because they know, they realize the importance of being present in this time as a whole, as a majority, and we have to be very connected, and we have to be together in this. This is very, very important. We cannot tolerate this in any way possible. And for me, this is like a peaceful army that we're doing. Like, there's a lot of Puerto Ricans everywhere in the world, and we're showing the people how we protest, even though we're not a country that is used to protesting. But when we do, we show the people and we educate how we do protest and how we never stop.
You use the word country, and I want to focus on that as we wrap up this segment, because last year you were with us on the show last August, and during that conversation you said you wanted Puerto Rico to be an independent country. Do you think that the current protest movement, Ile, is going to fuel calls for Puerto Rican independence from the United States?
I don't know. We're focusing on the main goal here, that the governor renounces or resigns. But obviously, I hope for my country to be independent, but not tied to any political party. I think being independent is just like what our path should be. Like when we grow up, we grew up to be independent people, where our country should be independent as well and be protected by their own people that love the country better than any other. So for me, I don't know what's going to happen. We're little by little fighting for what corresponds to us, but I just hope for the best and the well-being of my country.
Ile is a Puerto Rican singer and songwriter, and her latest album, Almadura, is out today. Ile, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
De luna a luna me hiciste tuya y sin querer quise ser tuya. De luna a luna me abandonaste y al ocaso tú me entregaste. De luna, luna, sin rodillas.
We're going out with a track from Ile's new album. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.
En cada salto, en cada creta, huesos gaviotas, los que te llevan. Y una nariz se hace vereda, mi rostro cruza todas sus veras. De luna a luna fui suficiente, de luna a luna no quise verte.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.